This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Dr. Scott Bahn about his book, Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War on Iraq.
Manipulation of the public and the manufacturing of consent, in Chomsky's terms, are just as relevant now as they were in 2003 when they launched the war against Iraq.
It's been nearly 50 years since Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique. Today we speak with author Stephanie Kuntz about her book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s.
What did people think in the 60s when they read this book, and what do they think today?
Stay with us. Michael, I hear that there have been some recent developments concerning your favorite judge, Clarence Thomas.
There sure have been. And the reason that he's my favorite judge is this. You know, there's a mystique that surrounds certain professions in this country, doctors, priests, lawyers, and especially judges. And Thomas, I think, single-handedly has done more to explode that mystique than any other lawyer in America. It started out, remember when he was nominated by Bush's father, George Sr., 20-some years ago.
It was that long.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
But I tell you, it's so fresh in my memory. BAI broadcast the confirmation hearings in the Senate, and I listened to every minute of it. I remember most distinctly how he helped explode the mystique of the judges when Anita Hill took the stand to testify about what he had done to her, because she was his assistant and he was consistently harassing her sexually, proposing to her, making all kinds of lewd suggestions, trying to get her to come over to his house and watch porno movies.
And was he married at the time? Must not have been.
I don't think so. But that's what we're going to get to, his marriage in a minute. But in any case, but they were able to beat back Anita Hill's challenge, and they put him on the Supreme Court. How many years has he gone now without talking?
I read that we're coming up on 5 complete years.
So he sits there, listens to cases, and doesn't ask a question for 5 years.
Doesn't ask a question.
But he votes.
He votes.
You know how he votes. He always votes the same way Scalia votes.
Right.
The old joke is that Scalia's got 2 votes.
Right.
Anyway, so Thomas explodes the mystique further in the last couple of weeks doing the following. For one thing, his wife, who's this right-wing ideologue who works for one of the right-wing think tanks and gets $100,000 a year for her services and has been doing it for 20 years. So what's the math? $2 million?
I guess.
They failed to report it on their taxes.
I know.
And so they asked for permission to file an amended tax return after 20 years, and they got permission to do it, and they went and filed the amended tax return on a Saturday, like the IRS opened its door for them on Saturday. Right? But then it gets worse, because then it comes out that the Koch brothers, billionaire oil industry funders of the right wing and the Tea Party, the Koch brothers had a meeting of like-minded people in Palm Springs a couple weeks ago, that fancy suburb, really, of L.A., west of L.A. It's a beautiful place. Weird. They named the streets after Frank Sinatra and Bob Hope, and all these zillionaires live there. So Clarence Thomas shows up at the gathering. He gets paid by the Heritage Foundation for 4 days of hotels and food and all of that, and he doesn't report it.
Oh, right.
Which is...
Yeah. A
receiving
breach.
A gift,
yeah.
And not reporting it is also cheating on your income taxes. Common Cause asked the Supreme Court for a comment on this, and the spokesperson in the Supreme Court said he was only there momentarily. But the records show that he was there for 4 days. So Common Cause made a complaint against Clarence Thomas. So stay tuned.
Michael, you hail from Wisconsin, and there were some demonstrations there last week. What's happening there?
Well, I think it's of central importance because the new Tea Party-backed governor, Scott Walker, has announced that—and he's got a bill before the legislature that's going to pass—that the public unions in the state of Wisconsin no longer have any collective bargaining rights.
What? How
and
can he do that unilaterally?
Unions exist to collective bargain.
Of course.
Well, they put a bill in front of the legislature— They've got a majority in the legislature. He's going to give his speech, Scott Walker, to the legislature, but he's not going to do it at the state capitol. He's going to do it at the headquarters of a corporation called VitaPlus that manufactures animal feed because he doesn't want to be exposed to the public. There were 200,000 people that demonstrated around the state capitol. The line to testify snaked outside the door and around the Capitol several fold, but it's going to pass. And the right wing is looking upon this as the template, because if it passes in Wisconsin, if they can break the public unions in Wisconsin, then they're going to do it in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and so on. They've already reduced the size of the non-public unions by a huge amount in this country. The union movement is weaker than it's ever been, and now they're zeroing in on the public unions because those are the biggest unions in the country now.
Michael, there's got to be a lawsuit that the unions can bring against this.
And that's something that we can explore.
I would wonder if it would be related to First Amendment and their right to free association and communication.
Or the National Labor Relations Act, which
exactly.
gave the right to
right.
bargain collectively to begin with. I don't know the answer to that. We're going to have to speak with labor lawyers. We'll get them on the show as soon as we can, because this is of crucial importance. Wisconsin was historically a progressive state. AFSCME, the municipal union, was born in Wisconsin. Social Security, the original legislation, was drafted by a woman at the university there in 1937. When I was growing up, there was a socialist mayor in Milwaukee. Frank Zeidler.
What a disturbing change of direction for your proud state.
Yeah, exactly. So stay tuned on that, too.
And more people's movement hopefully coming out of there.
The attacks of 9/11 led to a war on Iraq. Although there was neither tangible evidence that the nation's leader, Saddam Hussein, was linked at all to Osama bin Laden, nor any proof of weapons of mass destruction. How, then, was propaganda and distortion used to garner support for the invasion of Iraq? Dr. Scott Bahn has a few theories in his new book, Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and U.S. War on Iraq. Bahn introduces a unique, integrated, and interdisciplinary theory called critical communication. We talk more with Scott A. Bahn, assistant professor of sociology at Drew University, who teaches courses in criminology and deviance. Professor Scott Bahn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the central theses of your book involves the term moral panic, and we haven't really talked about that before on Law and Disorder, although it's certainly something that pervades our modern society. Can you explain what a moral panic is?
Absolutely, Heidi. The moral panic concept it's actually a criminological concept that was developed by Stan Cohen over in the UK in the late 1960s. And essentially what it is, it's an exaggeration both in terms of the public response as well as a policy initiatives, oftentimes legislation, that is an overreaction to an alleged threat to society. And this threat to society is generally fueled by both the political elites who are alleging that there's a threat that must be dealt with, and then the media go along for the ride and fan the flames, and in many ways become the promotional channel for the campaign. This is the sort of theoretical framework that I use to examine the build-up to the Iraq War.
And I know, for example, we've seen rather hastily passed legislation, things like Megan's Law, legislation attached to high-profile events. That's the same kind of result of a moral panic.
Sure, and I would certainly argue that the Patriot Act resulted from the moral panic after 9/11.
With an unquestioning sort of consumer audience who believes what they see in the headlines.
Exactly, Heidi. I mean, that's the crux of it is that people become almost dependent upon the elites and rely on them to tell them the right thing when it isn't necessarily in the elite's best interest to do so. And when, in fact, they may be more concerned about passing their own agenda, pursuing their own goals, and keeping themselves in power than what's really good for society as a whole.
Well, let's talk first about how they engineered this consent, how they manufactured and stampeded people towards approving the war against Iraq. And then I wanted for the second part of the interview to talk about crimes committed by the Bush administration in the war. Your book, Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War in Iraq, covers those two aspects very well. We wanted to be able to explicate both of them. How did they engineer this consent? I remember seeing Colin Powell, when he was head of the armed forces, testifying at the United Nations about how they had weapons of mass destruction. He had a little piece of one in his hand that he held up. How did you come to grips with what they did and expose it?
Well, thank you for the question, Michael. I was, you know, like many of us, listening to the war drums pounding in 2001, 2002, and early 2003, leading up to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, and where it really became apparent to me that this was an advertising campaign, if you will, is when Andy Card, if you remember, he was the White House chief of staff during the first term. He was presented by the press corps one morning right around Labor Day of 2002. Someone in the press corps stood up and said, Andy, you know, we're hearing about these weapons of mass destruction from Iraq and that there's an imminent threat. What's going on? Are we going to war? And you have to remember the timing here. It was right at the end of the summer. And Andy's response was, he said, timing is everything. From a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products over the summer.
Precisely.
Stunning.
If there was ever an indication to me that we have some, salesmanship going on here, it was certainly that, which I couldn't believe how callous, you know, that was. But to be more specific, what I looked at is immediately after 9/11, new terminology came into public airwaves and through the Bush administration. Terms like axis of evil, evildoers, madmen, mad dogs, you know, terminology like this. And it was used ever increasingly toward Iraq and this alleged threat. And they tied this to imagery of 9/11, made allusions to mushroom clouds and smoking guns, and indicating that if we didn't do something about Iraq, that we would have a repeat of 9/11. So what I did is I looked at the actual rhetoric of the Bush administration over a 3-year period leading up to the Iraq War. And then I looked at public opinion polls measured by the Gallup organization, in which Gallup asked the public on 25 separate occasions leading up to the war, do you favor or oppose going to war? And interestingly, and consistent with my prediction, as the rhetoric became ever more inflammatory toward Iraq and punitive, and as the volume cranked up higher and higher, guess what? Public opinion just mirrored it, directly mirrored the rhetoric itself. So much so that by the just before the invasion began on March 19th of 2003, 70% of the public agreed with going to war, and almost an identical 70% believed that Iraq was in fact involved in 9/11, and that Saddam Hussein did have these massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction that they had mentioned.
Scott, I have actually two questions. One is, if you can explain what you mean by the term critical communication. And the other is if you can talk a bit about the relevance of this type of manipulation 9 years later.
Sure, absolutely. By critical communication, it's a theory that I have developed, and it certainly has its foundation in Chomsky's notion of manufacturing consent. It also has its foundation in critical sociology, and in particular the Frankfurt School of Social Research over in Frankfurt, Germany. And what those individuals were doing, the latter group, the Frankfurt individuals, they were looking at the dawn of the Nazi Party back in the 20s and 30s. And they noticed how in the modern world, oppression can be very subtle and very even seemingly attractive and entertaining. And how the media and film and poetry and music and art can be actual forms of oppression if there are lies that are being disseminated. And so this, I developed a theory which essentially argues that it oftentimes is in the interests. It's in the interests of the elites of portraying what might seem to be an attractive picture, and do it through sound bites, do it through seemingly effective or convincing information, But in fact, it's all lies. But it's served up in a very attractive way. Like you mentioned, Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations right before the war began. Well, it was a beautiful multimedia presentation, and we now know that it was complete falsehood.
Hugh Hader was asked about it, and he said that was not one of my finest moments.
Absolutely, and his chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, has gone as far as to say that, you know, they were sold a bill of goods by his boss and given a, you know, basic handed the bag to to carry over and finish the deal and put the final nail in the coffin, but it was all lies. In fact, one of the more amusing things, anecdotally, in that regard is remember, they showed they had those animated trucks that Colin Powell was showing, and he said that these were mobile biological weapon labs over in Iraq.
I remember.
And do you remember what they were when they finally got over there?
No.
They were mobile weather stations.
Well,
I mean, it's not funny, but right. In an ironic way, it is. But it's a testimony to just, you know, the lies that were being disseminated. And Heidi, back to the second part of your question, you know, why is this important? Well, I think one of the big messages of my book is let's not get fooled again. And in terms of critical communication theory, part of my argument is let's be critical consumers. Let's not just passively drink the tainted Kool-Aid of hatred and fear without questioning what the motives of the server are.
Which becomes difficult with the conglomeration of corporate media, and really difficult for people on their own to get at the truth.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And 90% of the world's media outlets are controlled by just six multimedia conglomerates. So your point is well taken. And if we don't believe, if for anyone who doesn't believe that the notion of freedom of the press is really more of a myth than a reality, and that the tone of the news and the framing and the ideology doesn't reflect the ownership, all one has to do is look at Rupert Murdoch and Fox News. He's self-proclaimed one of the most conservative businessmen in the world, and Fox News certainly has a framing of issues that is very different than most any other major news outlet.
Scott Bond, author of Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War in Iraq. It was announced yesterday by President Obama in handing out the coveted Medal of Freedom that one of the recipients was George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama said, without irony, "We celebrate an extraordinary life of service and sacrifice." And I mention that because I want to segue into the second part of your book, which is war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about what the results were of this campaign of mass deception.
Well, that's a great question, Michael, and thank you for that segue, because, yes, I'm really making two propositions in my book, and the first we've talked about a bit here, and that is this, you know, essentially an advertising campaign that was used to sell the Iraq war on the public. And then the second part of it, which has received really much less attention and critical scrutiny by the public and as well as the media, and that is the fact that laws were broken here. International laws were broken. And I find it so ironic that the United States was one of the co-authors of the laws of war, the Nuremberg Charter, the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions after the atrocities of World War II, and these are the very sacred treaties that George W. Bush violated and his administration. You know, in particular, the Nuremberg Charter, which says a war of aggression is the first crime from which all other war crimes follow, so an unprovoked attack. And the Iraq invasion in March of 2003 was, in fact, an unprovoked attack. And, of course, the way that they attempted to justify it and rationalize it was on this, you know, the notion of the Bush doctrine of preemptive self-defense. Well, as soon as I heard that term, preemptive self-defense, I said to myself, that sounds like an oxymoron. You know, it's either preemptive or it's self-defense. How can it be both? And they attempted to support it and rationalize it based upon Article 51 of the UN Charter, which does allow for self-defense. But it went way beyond that. Essentially, what the Bush Doctrine was is that we have the right to proactively and preemptively strike anyone who may someday be a threat to us. you know, imagine applying that same law of self-defense to our society. That means, you know, Heidi, if I thought that you might be a threat to me someday, I could come and kill you and then just claim self-defense because I knew you were going to do it down the road. You know, I mean, it's basically the same thing.
Well, there's no objective standard there. It's all subjective.
It would
lead to a chaotic world. It's a very scary concept that they employed.
Yeah, it really is. And the thing is, you know, it's even more subtle. Is even, you know, we know that there were just complete lies. There were no massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, and they knew it too. There's ample evidence that they knew it as well, but went ahead with it anyway. But the subtle reality here is, Michael, that even if Iraq had possessed the weapons of mass destruction, if there wasn't either a concerted effort, an imminent threat, or it was already underway, Iraq using them against us, there would have still been no basis for a self-defense claim on the part of the Bush administration.
Precisely. Scott, I know from reading your book that you have a background as a media executive before you went into academia. Keeping that in mind, I wanted to ask you, what do we do, what do our listeners do to not be fooled again?
Thank you. As a matter of fact, having that background, you know, I worked in advertising, I worked at NBC, I was actually a vice president at NBC in the 90s, and it was certainly that experience that gave me a firsthand view of exactly how news is created. And I would just like to say that, you know, we when we turn on the TV, when we open the paper, we think, well, you know, this is news. Well, it's only news because someone who has the power to make it news decides that it is. So there's always vested interest. There's always an agenda that's being forwarded anytime something becomes a quote news item. And even more important than the issue itself is the framing of that issue. How is it presented to us? Is it presented in a positive way? Is it presented in a negative way? In the case of Iraq, of course, it was presented as this imminent alleged threat that must be dealt with right now, or else we'll be dealing with another 9/11 situation. I mean, that's essentially was the framing that that the Bush administration did. Now, you know, in regards to, you know, how to react or how to respond, therein lies the problem, because, you know, we're, as a society, we're not a highly critical, scrutinizing, or frankly, for that matter, intellectual society for the most part. There's this tendency to just passively accept what we're told, treat it as real, and then move on. And especially when so-called information is served up in these sort of attractive little sound bites. And I mean, that's what Axis of Evil was all about. It was reducing something that was highly complex and in fact actually a lie, but making it sound, giving it an attractive sounding name and a name that conjures all sorts of an emotional response. But my answer to you is to be critical, to think about what it is. If the next time that we're told that we must respond, there is an imminent threat and we must act on it, is to ask ourselves why. You know, first of all, you know, is there any objective indication of a threat? What signs have we seen that there is a threat? Who's making the case? And what do they have to gain from it? We, you know, as the gatekeeper or agenda setter, what do they have to gain by making this claim? In whose interests? And if they're creating fear, then who can potentially benefit from the fear? And I would also say, don't get your information from just one source. And personally, I would never make that source Fox News.
I would say, make it Law and Disorder.
There you go,
Scott.
There you go.
It wasn't just the Iraq War, and you've touched on this. I think of so many campaigns out of the Bush administration, No Child Left Behind, partial life, abortions, terms that came out of nowhere, really, especially for the latter. To what extent did the Bush administration, to your knowledge, use advertising firms to consult with on creating a lot of these campaigns?
Well, they certainly, I mean, every administration utilizes media experts, and arguably Bush had the master in Karl Rove. Karl Rove is an expert at measuring public opinion and developing strategies, and we might as well call them advertising strategies because that's really what they are. I'm going to tell you something that I've talked about in my book, and I think it's just an absolutely fascinating phenomenon, finding that I didn't expect to find, but I think your listeners would be really interested to hear this. When I took the examination of public opinion polls through the Gallup organization, I found that the first time that Gallup asked the question whether or not the U.S. public was prepared to go to war in Iraq, the first time they asked it was less than 2 weeks after Bush took office as president in 2001, literally 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks before or after he took office. And they never asked the question again until after 9/11. So it begs the question, why didn't they ask the question during the Clinton administration, and why did they ask it less than 2 weeks after Bush took office? And I can only come up with two possible scenarios without being a, you know, a conspiracy theorist, which I don't claim to be or want to be. The only two logical conclusions I can come up with is either A, the folks at Gallup are just really, really savvy, and they said, gee, it's probably on the Bush short-term agenda to go to Iraq, so let's see what the public thinks. Or B, Karl Rove or someone in the Bush administration called up Gallup and said, would you take a temperature, you know, give of the public, see what the current temperature is, right, on Iraq?
Yeah.
And see how much selling we're going to have to do? Yeah, those are the only conclusions I can come to, and I think that's you know, is an indication of it did two things for me. It gave me a barometer, a starting point for doing my analysis, and for the Bush administration at that time, it did the same thing. It told them how much selling that they were in fact going to have to do.
Well, I wanted to ask you in conclusion, Scott, what are they trying to sell now?
Who is they?
The power elites in this country, particularly the current Democratic administration.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm very disappointed, and this is getting back to the second proposition of my book. I'm very disappointed with the way that Obama has handled the situation in Iraq, looking backward in terms of not scrutinizing, not asking difficult questions, not investigating the war crimes. And then at the same time, looking forward at his Afghanistan campaign, all he's done is escalate an unnecessary war over there. And I'm very disturbed by that. And there seems to be no real or meaningful end in sight. And I would go so far as to say that what he's looking for in terms of Afghanistan is simply something to sell as a victory. You know, I don't know what a victory would be in Afghanistan. You know, forced democracy is another oxymoron. But I think he is looking for something to sell as a victory, particularly to conservatives. Now, with back to Iraq once again, you know, there's a wonderful saying that if you did not learn from history, you're condemned to repeat it. I respect Obama. I think he's a very intelligent man. But unless we really scrutinize what the Bush administration has done, then shame on us. Shame on us as a country. Shame on him as a president, because crimes were committed here, and the enlightened know it, and it deserves to be public, and people should be punished. And well, you notice that Bush even canceled his upcoming trip, because there's an excellent chance. There's an excellent chance that depending where he goes in Europe, if it's a country that is very much, you know, on board with the Rome Statute and supports the authority of the World Court in The Hague, that, you know, Bush could be scooped up and taken off to The Hague.
From your mouth to God's ears, Professor Scott Abon, author of Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War on Iraq, thank you so much for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Scott. Have a good day.
You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Strange stirring. The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s is the title of Stephanie Kuntz's new book. It's based on an explication of post-war gender roles and nearly 200 interviews with women and men who read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique in 1963. The Feminine Mystique is a passionate account of the problem with no name, the malaise, emptiness, and frustration afflicting white middle-class wives and mothers in a time of post-war abundance. Stephanie Kuntz is a social historian who teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She joins us in the studio today to talk more about her book.
Stephanie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Stephanie, you've written this really excellent book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. The Feminine Mystique, of course, was Betty Friedan's famous book, and you've taken another look at it. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, who was Betty Friedan, and what was she talking about when she said the feminine mystique?
Well, there's so many myths about who Betty Friedan was, and some of them she contributed to herself. When she starts the book, she essentially solidarizes herself with the homemakers that she's speaking to, the middle-class homemakers, and even takes partial blame for having created the feminine mystique by working for the women's magazines and writing for them. But as it turns out, Daniel Horowitz did a wonderful book about her own political history. She actually had quite a bit of experience thinking about working class women and women's rights. She was a star psychology student at Smith who already had developed her critique of the Freudianism that was so prevalent in those days when talking about women. And she also worked for left-wing union organizations. But when she came to this, she was just like, I'm a fellow victim. And so when you say what the feminine mystique was, she didn't invent it. Sometimes people think that Friedan invented or discovered the discontent of American housewives. Actually, people had been talking about it for years. Physicians had a name for it, the housewives syndrome. Then she starts out the book, in fact, I take my title from her first paragraph, where she talks about how women, as they buttered their children's peanut butter sandwiches, slept in their bed at night, felt this yearning, this strange stirring, and were afraid to ask themselves, what is the matter with my life? They might think it was their husband. They might think it was they needed a second car. But she says, no, what's the problem with you is it's not your own fault. You're not crazy. It's that you have been denied access to any source of meaning in your life other than that of being a wife or mother. And of course, you're discontented with that. And the whole book is this extended defense of women's right to find some meaning in their life, not aside from, not in opposition to, but on top of any role they had as wife or mother.
So that's the feminine mystique. You then wrote a book about that in some way, but why is it coming up all of a sudden? Your book, I just read an article in the New Yorker. This was 40, 50 years ago when Betty Friedan wrote that book.
Well, the article in the New Yorker was really a response to my book. I don't think he'd been doing that independently.
I got it.
But the way I got in it, I wish I could claim some, you know, tremendous forethought in this. But actually, it's kind of a funny story because my editor at Basic Books at the time approached me and said, listen, we're doing a series of biographies, not of great individuals, but of great books. And how'd you like to do one of The Feminine Mystique? Well, of course, anybody who was in the 60s or 70s really had heard of The Feminine Mystique. It was it sold 3 million copies. It was discussed. She had a tremendous knack for stirring up controversy, and so she was on the radio and TV all the time. So my mother had talked to me about it a lot, of course, heard about it, and I said to myself, oh, gosh, that'll be good. I'll go back and reread The Feminine Mystique, and I'll assign it to my students. So I ordered the book for my class, and I sat down to read it. And about halfway through the first chapter, I said, I've never read this book. And I don't even like this book. Oh, my gosh, what have I gotten into? But
that's
that's kind of actually, you know, winnowing the I have 188 interviews at the end with these women and some men who did read her at the time, and that was a very powerful experience talking to them. But actually winnowing it down to 188 was difficult because I would keep getting calls and emails from people who swore they had read the book. It was the same thing. There was something about that title that was just like an empty receptacle that you could pour all your hopes or fears or discontents into, and so lots of people thought they'd read the book when they they hadn't.
Stephanie, I'm curious, how did you come to interview these specific individuals? What was your pool?
Because of my own, and it's sort of to honor my own mother, who never became a famous person, a leader of now or something, but whose life was really changed by reading it, I wanted to not do the usual Betty Friedan tour of all of the people who went on with her to form 3 years later the National Organization for Women, who knew her personally. So I was just looking for people who had read her, and I kind of used a rolling convenience sample. I posted on listservs, any that I could find, some women's studies, but I also asked the Ladies' Home Journal to post notices, and I got some emails from that too. And then you would meet, actually probably the best beginning of my sample was just from the staff, not the faculty so much as the staff at the Evergreen State College where I work, and they would say, well, I knew somebody who did, and they'd introduce me to someone who did. And as I said, a lot of people had these vivid memories of having read her without doing it, but once you got to the ones who'd really read her, oh my goodness, they could remember where they were and what they were doing when they read that book. One woman that I just was my intellectual heroine, I could never believe that she would ever have been unself-confident in her life, described to me that she started crying halfway through the first chapter, and she flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet halfway through the book.
Well, in fact, that the issue of depression was very real in the 50s and 60s for women. How has that changed now?
Well, one of the things I found in this book is that Friedan only spoke to a narrow layer of women. And at first, when I first read it, I was sort of disappointed. You know, my dad was a union activist. I was like, where are the working class women? Where are the African American women in this? And she did not speak to them. She was speaking to a generation of women that was caught between two worlds. They were middle class or just newly moved into the middle class more often because they'd married a man who was moving into the middle class in the prosperity of the 1950s, taking advantage of the GI Bill. And from they weren't people who had a feminist consciousness at all, although there were plenty of those people still around from the 20s and 30s. But when you went to college in the 1920s, you were already defying your role as a woman. And most women who did were actually committed to women's liberation. Suddenly in the 50s, it became good to go to college for a middle-class woman or a working-class woman aspiring to get her MRS degree. But it was not good to use that education afterwards. And in fact, when you went to college, one of the first things you read were the psychiatrists and the sociologists who said that if you wanted to do that, if you wanted to work, if you wanted to pursue ideas in your own life other than your husband's achievement, you were suffering from a bad case of penis envy and were probably sort of, if not pathological, at least highly neurotic. So these were the women who went to college, they got their MRS degree, often they dropped out of college to do so. The only higher degree that they were encouraged to get was what was called the PhD, putting hubby through. Put your hubby through and then bask in his accomplishments. So they got it. They moved into the middle class, they had better jobs, they had better homes than their mothers and grandmothers, they were coming out of the hardships of depression and World War II. Their mothers had said to them, this is the absolute pinnacle of achievement, and they were not happy. And so they turned it in on themselves. This is what that I really appreciate Friedan for doing. The pain of these women was different from that of working class women who were working at demeaning jobs, of African American women facing racism. But it was more turned inward because it was like, what's wrong with me that I don't feel more grateful for my privileges? People would tell me, there were people being lynched down south. I had all of these privileges. What right did I have? But telling yourself you don't have the right to be unhappy doesn't solve it. It just turns it into that kind of depression you were talking
about.
The
problem with no name was what she called it. But talk to us, Stephanie Kuntz, about the social status of women, legal and otherwise, and how it evolved from the 20s to the 60s. And then I want to talk about what's going on today.
Sure. Well, I think most people looking back realize that women were discriminated against if they wanted jobs in the 1960s. And I'll just go over that very briefly because it's interesting that stay-at-home homemakers were at least as discriminated against as women who wanted jobs. But, I mean, if you want your epitome of the discrimination, we're talking about Law and Disorder. There are now three women on the Supreme Court, right? The first was Sandra Day O'Connor, who was appointed in 1981 when she graduated second in her class from Stanford Law School, having edited the prestigious Law Review. No firm that she wrote to in California would hire her, except one firm said, we don't hire women attorneys, but we'd be happy to have you as a legal secretary. If you had to get a job or wanted to get a job, you had to turn to the help wanted female section of the newspaper. There was none of the anti-discrimination laws that we have now. You could advertise, and employers did advertise, for pretty, well-groomed. One employer of the ads in the New York Times in 63 said, you must be really beautiful. That ad appeared several times, so I think they must have had very high standards about it. Then there was nothing to prevent your employer from firing you if you objected to sexual harassment, for example, which wasn't even illegal till 1993. You could be fired if you got married, if you got pregnant, if you were in the airline industry, if you turned 30, as one of the airline industry said, well, you know, you put a dog on an airplane and the businessmen aren't going to fly the airlines anymore, so we got to get rid of them. Just incredible discrimination against working women. But, and this is something most people don't realize, stay-at-home housewives didn't have rights either. There were only 8 states that recognized a wife's interest in the property or earnings that her husband accumulated. Those were the community property states, but even in the community property states, the husband had the right to decide how much of that would be used, and he could even leave a share of the property to someone else, which the wife didn't have to do. But in those other states, a homemaker had no rights. You know, if they got a divorce, she was just up a creek unless she could get some alimony out of proving fault. And by the way, proving fault, I'm sorry to babble, but I was just kind of stunned by this.
I read these facts when you wrote them, and I was really shocked.
I know,
by them.
Even if you lived through the era,
I mean, I was in that era.
To look back, and I'm like,
really amazed. I knew there was hardly anyone in my law school class who was a woman. There were like 300 men and like 12 women, but the 42 states
and
had
nothing. People think, you know,
women.
That before no-fault divorce, women were better off. No. For example, if a man had the right to decide where the couple lived, if he moved away and she refused to follow, he could charge her with desertion and get one of the fault-based divorces.
Amazing.
Well, talk to us now about, obviously, all this has changed. One of the triumphs of the movement of the 60s that we can be proud of. Nonetheless, I think there are still real problems. I mean, Sex and the City is put up as some kind of goal to achieve, you know. Talk to us about how things are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. One of the big triumphs of feminism is that so much of Betty Friedan's book is so dated today. It's not something I would ever assign in my class today. You know, they were rolling their eyes, except at one particular chapter. There's one chapter called The Sexual Cell, in which she talks about how marketers target housewives and try to convince them that they're going to get all their needs met by buying new stuff. Now that's changed. Now they target young women and they say to them, you can't, I think they've overcome the old feminine mystique. They say, yeah, you don't have to play dumb anymore to catch a man. You can be, you know, very good at sports. You can aspire to all these occupations that you see on the TV after 10 o'clock at night, you know, district attorneys, all of these wonderful lawyers and stuff that you see that are now overrepresented in the in the press in ways that they were underrepresented before. But you have to be totally hot. There's a lot of pressure on women to be consumers. But there's also a lot of pressure on men, too. I think one of the other big triumphs of the feminist movement is that it's really much more complicated than it used to be to talk about organizing for women's rights without talking about the issues that men face today. You know, it used to be, for example, that if you had a college education and worked full-time, you still earned less than the average high school male. And that was true for blacks, too, of course. College-educated blacks made less than high school graduates and even high school dropouts. Today, young women in their 20s out-earn men in many major metropolitan areas because they have more education. Education now outweighs the master status of gender or race. And men, as you know, young men are falling behind in many ways. So one of our big challenges is how do we address the continuing vulnerabilities of women to things like the sexual cell and the haughty mystique and the motherhood penalties, and still also address the fact that, that there are plenty of men in the same boat. And that there are now cross-cutting currents of inequality that are much more complex.
We're speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, who's just come out with a strange stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, a wonderful book. I urge people to get it and read it. Stephanie, talk to us, will you, about what your notions are of how you can avoid the problems that Betty Friedan addressed in terms of working a fulfilling job and have a loving family at the same time. What do you tell people when they talk to you about those sorts of problems?
Well, the good news is this, that if you are one of the women who has been able to take advantage of the new educational opportunities that are open to women and you can get a high-quality job, your life has never been better. We talk about the stresses of balancing work and family, but those are the women who have the most satisfying marriages. They report the best sex lives, too, contrary to the mythology that women who work at high-pressured jobs are too tired to do anything else. They're no more likely to be tired than housewives, and in fact, they report very, very good relationships in their marriages. And of course, if they're single or lesbian, they're also much better off and have many more options than they did in the past. But of course, there are two issues with just, we don't want to rest on our laurels. First of all, the rewarding jobs are still organized on the basis that every employee who has access to a rewarding job will have someone at home to take care of the rest of life. And so it is very, very stressful. And it's not just a woman's problem. Men now report more work-family conflict than women do because I think the feminist movement has raised their expectations of them also participating in family life. And of course, if you work at a low-paid job and a really unfamily-friendly job, that is a tremendous pressure. The people who are having the most difficult time are the women who would prefer to be homemakers, but have had to take a job, a low-quality job, for financial reasons, and whose husbands do not help out at home. The happiest women are the ones who prefer to work and have a high-quality job and a husband who helps out at home. And I have to say, you know, people talk a lot about the second shift, but that's actually not accurate anymore. Men have made remarkable strides in taking on a share of housework and childcare. And maybe back in the 1950s, the male breadwinner, female nurturer division was the most stable, not necessarily the happiest, but the most stable marriage system. We're now finding that the most stable marriages are those where there's more sharing of housework, childcare, and breadwinning.
Anti-feminism today, is it on the ascendancy? Is it been neutralized? Are there things that people ought to be looking to about the people who are going after feminism, particularly Friedan and Forward?
Uh-huh. Well, it's complicated, I think, because very few people call themselves anti-feminist today. I mean, you get the nutty emails whenever I'm on the radio show from the guys who complain that, you know, feminists cut their balls off at some point or something. But most people say that they totally support women's rights. I think the real threat to Friedan's good parts of Friedan feminism, the idea that men and women together will have better lives if they can share access to rewarding work and rewarding family life. The worst threats to those sometimes are the ones who pretend to be our allies. You know, the lipstick feminist idea that if it's long, you know, long as you're hot, you know, that you can empower yourself by buying the best consumer goods and having the best sex and having the best career. Or the other feminists, so-called feminists, who say, well, of course we want to look out for women, but after all, the stick is bent in the other direction now, and a lot of women would prefer to be home. That's not true. Actually, there are more female homemakers who would prefer to be working than working women who would prefer to be homemakers. So you get it coming from a lot of different aspects. I mean, I'm still stunned by how many young women say, I'm not a feminist, but, and then proceed to enumerate every single demand that the second wave feminist movement stood for. But I'm also upset when feminists lose sight of the fact that many of our struggles now are struggles for men as well, that men need work-family balance as much as we do. And when they lose sight of the fact, if their idea of feminism is that they should hire another low-paid woman to do the job in their home that they used to be doing in their home, I can understand why people are a little suspicious of that kind of feminism, too.
Can you talk about momism briefly?
Yes, momism was the 1950s home front equivalent of communism. There was this massive campaign in the 40s and 50s. It started in the 20s, actually, with psychiatrists saying that, listen, women have been too powerful in the home, and they've been claiming too much credit for all their self-sacrifice and virtue, and they're binding their sons to them with the silver cord, that's what it was called, and they're making their husbands jump through hoops, you know, because of their incessant demands on them. So what you have to do is we have to break with this. And Philip Wiley coined the term momism to describe what he called a she tyranny of not just career women, even worse than career women, stay-at-home mothers and wives who were tyrannizing men with their demands for respect, smothering their children, nagging their husbands to achieve. And that was picked up. The Freudians adopted the term as their own, and there was a massive campaign that people forget about getting rid of momism, mom and her apple pies, you know, terrible, terrible thing. Actually, Friedan echoes some of this in some of the more repellent parts of her books. She blames women, and she accepts the now discredited idea that smothering mothers create homosexual boys. But at least what she did is she said, well, if all that's true that you're claiming about the insidious effects of moms, why don't we give women some other way of finding meaning in their life other than through their sons and husbands? So at least she turned the discourse on its head.
One thing you read occasionally and in some of the stuff you've written is the answer, or really the question, about whether women were more satisfied back in the 60s than they are today. And there's some surveys that you see around that says, well, women were happier before The Feminine Mystique was published, and they're less happy today. And it's whatever term we want to use for the people pushing that line. What is the story with that?
Well, it's a complex story. Most of these surveys compare 1970 then with today's reports. And women do report themselves, homemakers, it's not because of working women, homemakers just as much as working women are less likely to say that they're happy here. But I think there's a couple of things you have to take into account. First of all, what's your trajectory? In 1970, you were just beginning to win these rights, and people were, like, so excited, and they didn't see any of the downside of it yet. What's your reference group? In 1970, women were still comparing themselves to men. You would hear people say, well, I had a pretty good job for a woman, you know? So their expectations were much lower. And I think the final thing is having researched the actual expectations that people had of happiness in the 50s and 60s, I don't know of any woman, whatever her politics, whatever her opinion of feminism, would want to go back to that. You would get sociologists, people would say, we have a happy marriage. And then the sociologists would dig a little, and they would describe these instances of abuse, of emotional contempt, of infidelity. And they would say, well, we have a happy enough marriage. He hardly ever hits me. He's much better. He's not a drunk like my father was. Of course, if they went to marriage counselors, they were told that anything in the marriage was their fault. Infidelity, be better groomed. Is he hitting you? Don't be so efficient and masculine. That provokes it. And then this wonderful comment that one psychologist, one social worker said, and when you look at these things, if you're going to blame feminism for the fact that women are less likely to report themselves very happy, and as I've just said, I really don't, you would also have to credit feminism with the fact that men report themselves happier than they used to be, in large part because they no longer feel that they have to do all of the breadwinning all by themselves.
One other point that you discuss is whether Friedan's book really focused on personal choice at the expense of everything else, looking at sort of this is, it's a me generation, and that's what feminism represented coming out of Friedan. And there's been, again, some controversy today about this question. Is what was Friedan talking about? Was she really talking about me,
these
or
people,
something else?
These people could never have read Betty Friedan. Friedan's book has a lot of problems. You know, there are things in it that I find absolutely repellent. And And I find her failure to deal with her own elitism very disconcerting. But oh my gosh, she is not a me-first individualist. What she is saying to people is, look, she specifically says, don't get a job just because it pays well. Get something that contributes something to society so that you can feel a sense of accomplishment and meaning. That's much better than just looking for money. She opposed what she called the sex seekers. She would have hated Sex in the City feminism. She said, women like men need to have a sense that they're doing something purposeful, meaningful in the world, and we both need to be able to cultivate that aspect of ourselves.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique, and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. You've sort of indicated where you think we ought to go. I mean, looking at what's happening with men as well. But can you just give our listeners some sense of how you look at the next half a dozen years in terms of the issues that Friedan began with?
Well, you know, I'm always get nervous when people ask me to predict the future because I don't think we need futurists. I think we need activists. We have to change that future. And we could go in a very bad direction because we've already seen an increasing divergence and inequality in family life in the same way that we've seen it in our economic life. Or we could start investing in jobs that pay well, that pay family wages so that people, not so that one man can support one woman, but that so a man and a woman can decide that they're secure enough to start planning for a future together. And we could start investing in jobs like every other Western nation in the world has done. We are just Neanderthals. Well, it's insulting to Neanderthals who used to care for their old to call us Neanderthals. But we could start building family-friendly jobs that allow people to have what Friedan believed, that access to meaning in our family lives, in our love lives, as well as in our work lives.
You opened when you talked about Friedan sort of knew better than the class or the way, the perspective she wrote that book from. And I think, for example, she worked at the United Electrical Workers, which was a very progressive union. And she had a history, not maybe that dissimilar to some of your own families, but a history in the progressive movements. And yet, you read the book and it's nothing about that. And as you said, it's from a sort of very narrow class perspective. What was going on for her?
Well, there were a couple of things. First of all, she did sneak in a few references to oppressed workers and civil rights. This was McCarthyism, remember, when people would be called in and blacklisted forever if they had admitted to these kinds of associations. And she had already in her personal life started to move away from working for the union movement to developing a career as a freelance writer. And so she was very much exposed to the dilemmas and discontents of middle-class homemakers, and she hoped to channel them in a more progressive direction, and she felt that she had to downplay her past political associations. You know, I can understand some of it. I don't understand the extent to which she persisted in making this story for the rest of her life, and I was very disappointed by her failure to deal with African-American women in the book, because she actually was leading, even as she was writing this, battles for integration in the communities in which she lived, but she just sort of wrote them out of her book when she could have pointed to them, not white feminists. It was black leaders of both sexes who originally said that women needed to develop a tripart identity as wives and mothers, as co-breadwinners, and as community activists. So she really missed a bet by not saying to those middle-class housewives, some people do it.
Well, Stephanie, thank you for this really remarkable interview, and we wish you good luck with the book. Again, we're speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, the author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique, and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.